In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about Mexico and Mexican politics, and particularly the changes in Mexico that have happened, roughly speaking, over the last 30 years as the country has gone through something of a democratic revolution. It began in 1968 with the killing of a group of student protesters by government troops, and ultimately it culminated in the election of Vicente Fox in 2000, ending 70 years of dominance by one political party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking with two reporters who covered Mexico for the New York Times, Julia Preston and Samuel Dillon. They were the Mexico correspondents for the Times from 1995 until 2000, and were part of the team at the paper there that won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting in 1998. They have co-authored a book which is titled Opening Mexico, The Making of a Democracy, that looks at this 30-year period and how much politics in Mexico changed over that time. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's out now in the bookstores, and we'll try to talk, at least hit some of the high points of this history in this part of Focus 580, and perhaps also talk a little bit about what is going on now in Mexico. And, of course, questions are welcome. We want to tell people that you're certainly free to call in if you have a question. We do, however, ask callers to be brief, and we ask that so we can keep the program moving and get as many people in as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. And the local number is 333-9455. Well, Julia Preston, hello.
Hello.
And Samuel Dillon, hello to you.
Nice to hear you.
Well, thank you both very much for talking with us. There's a lot in this book, and so as I said, I guess we'll try and see if we can hit some of the high points, beginning with what happened in 1968. But before that, I thought I'd ask you to talk a little bit about the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which is generally known by its initials, PRI, the PRI. This was a party that was formed in 1929, although at the time it was called something else. And when finally the PRI lost the presidency there in 2000, when Vicente Fox won, at that point it had held the presidency 12 times in a row. The term, presidential term in Mexico, is 6 years, so we're talking about 72 years there. And I think it was the longest ruling party anywhere.
Yes, that's right.
At the time. So what was it? How did the PRI manage to dominate Mexican politics for so long?
The PRI rose out of the chaos of the Mexican Revolution, and at the time that it was formed, I think Mexicans had a real yearning for an orderly political process. And the PRI very cleverly and ably capitalized on that permanent yearning by Mexicans for order to become a party that had a level of hegemony that I think many Americans don't understand. At the height of its powers, the PRI controlled not only the presidency, but every governor, state house in the nation, most municipalities. They controlled the elections process, the labor unions, the business association. They controlled the press. It was a kind of a generalized one-party control that was really, virtually complete in Mexican life. The central mechanism was that the president was able to choose his own successor, so that the system was self-perpetuating in that way. And to be a dissident in Mexico, to either try and run against the party in an election or question the party's intelligence, could be highly dangerous for Mexicans. It was a party that was repressive either by marginalizing people, exiling people, or, if necessary, resorting to violence.
Let's talk then about what happened in 1968, because as you lay the story out here, we're talking about perhaps a series of small steps, but steady, that moves us in the direction from that point to Vicente Fox and his winning the presidential election in 2000. 1968 in Mexico, like a lot of other places, was a time of student activism, and there was a student revolt going on at that time. It was in the summer. Mm-hmm. And in the events here we're talking about, this happened actually in October.
Well, it was a summer of protest. Mm-hmm. And you've said it correctly that, remember, 1968 was a year in which student rebellion swept the globe. There was the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Russian troops, and Paris was there were fights between police and students there, and in Germany, and at Kent State University in Ohio, there was the confrontation with the National Guard. So, in a certain way, Mexican students were reflecting the zeitgeist of that moment. But it was also there was a singular ambiance in Mexico at that point, because you were getting a society that had been largely a society of peasants and simple craftsmen and workers that was then maturing into a more cosmopolitan modern society with a burgeoning middle class. And so the outbreak of this summer's violence began with just a stupid fight between police and some kids that were actually playing touch football in downtown Mexico in the street. And the police these were police with truncheons and just very clumsy tactics that were designed to crush the kind of demonstrations of the past that were of a former era. So they completely overreacted, and they beat these students. They ran into a school and just completely very violent. And as a result, the entire sort of student and university community of first the metropolitan area and then later all of Mexico went on strike. And it ignited a larger fervor in the middle class, and so you ended up getting a whole summer of very, very large demonstrations.
Well, what then happened in October when there was the killings? Their security forces fired on a student demonstration, and there were a lot of people either killed or wounded. What happened?
It was an incredible overreaction. The problem was that you had these demonstrations escalating over the summer, and you had a very repressive president, a scheming. He was actually a somewhat Nixonian kind of president, although sort of Nixonian to the nth degree, very insecure, brooding. And he was a man that was completely offended by the idea that students would challenge his authority. And in the backdrop was the scheduled International Olympics that were coming in October for Mexico City, which was a huge milestone for an underdeveloped country like Mexico to showcase the economic progress that they've had. So the president was extremely anxious to make sure that there were no further protests at the time of the Olympics. And so what he did is he set a trap. He learned that the students and this middle class movement had scheduled another one of their democratic demonstrations for the large plaza that's surrounded by very large, very tall, like 20-story apartment buildings on three sides, called Tlatelolco, and he sent troops to surround the complex with the protesters inside, and then without telling the army, he positioned snipers on the roofs and in the apartments overlooking the plaza. The snipers in plain clothes shot not only on the students, but they also shot on the army. Actually, one of them injured the general of the paratroop battalion that was involved in the surrounding sort of blockade movement by the troops. And the result was that the troops completely went crazy, shooting back at the snipers, shooting wildly. This became just kind of an orgy of violence, a lot like the Tiananmen Square situation in China. And it ended up taking on much of the same sort of democratic symbolism as that a massacre in China.
At the time, though, I don't think it was exactly what happened and position, particularly this, the fact that the government had put these snipers out and had them fire at both the crowd and the soldiers. This didn't come out till later, though, isn't that?
Well, right? that was one of the challenges for the democratic movement. This massacre marked the movement, marked a generation of Mexicans, because up until that point, the vast majority of Mexicans had accepted the basic concept that their government was promoting their well-being and was essentially a benevolent government. From that moment on, that sort of acceptance of the government as a legitimate authority and a positive system was snapped. And so thereafter, you had a movement of people seeking democratic change. And one of the challenges for them then became to clarify what happened in this incredible massacre, because obviously there was a government cover-up. Mm-hmm. The government story was that the students had been carrying guns and that they'd shot on the troops and that they'd caused the violence. And they actually ended up trying and convicting, I think, about 150 of the students for murder. It was all for the murder of the same soldier. They had, 150 students convicted of murdering the same soldier. But that the process of peeling back the layers in this onion of cover-up took about 30 years. We were fortunate enough to be in Mexico in 1998, which was the 30th anniversary of this massacre. Mm. And it was an incredible outpouring of thousands of people converged on this plaza with candles, and they had an incredible vigil. By that time, Mexico had obviously changed extraordinarily, and so the Mexico City was at that time under the control of the opposition. But in the same year, there were a number of there was an outpouring of investigative reporting and historical research, and files were opened. And that's you're absolutely right. That's when 30 years later they were able to establish the full story of how the snipers had been ordered to the scene by President Díaz Ordaz. Mm.
Let me introduce again our guests. The last voice you heard belongs to Samuel Dillon, also talking with us this morning, Julia Preston. They were Mexico correspondents for The New York Times from 1995 until 2000, and the co-authors of a book that talks about the political change that happened in Mexico over roughly the last 30 years. It's titled Opening Mexico, The Making of a Democracy. Farrar Straus Giroux is the publisher. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. The next big shock probably was a literal one. This was in 1985. There was an earthquake, a major earthquake. It hit Mexico City. And apparently there was a lot of popular anger directed at the PRI for its failure to respond. And one of the things that happened was that people, in order to respond, people started to organize themselves independent of the PRI. And perhaps that was the first time that something like that had really happened.
Well, the PRI was a demobilizing party in general. It discouraged any form of grassroots community organization outside of its own structures. The principle of the party was that all authority and all wisdom came from the top down. However, the wise men of the PRI failed to react in the first days after the earthquake. The earthquake, as you probably know, shattered much of downtown Mexico City. Many people were killed, and the government authorities, up to the president himself, Miguel de la Madrid, were paralyzed. They were not in evidence at all for the first 48 hours, and people immediately took to the streets in an effort to both recover the survivors and save the survivors, but also increasingly to recover the remains of their dead. And it became a frontal struggle between the government and some of these communities where the worst damage had been. At one point, Sam and I covered a situation that developed at a public hospital, and there was much suspicion that this public hospital had collapsed so extensively because of corruption in the original construction of the hospital. There were signs, all kinds of signs of weakness and flaws in the construction that came to light after these buildings fell down. And we were there when there was a confrontation between the government, which wanted to bulldoze the buildings, and with the argument that they could become a source of disease. And the people who were still trying to recover the remains of their dead. And at one point, after the government had ordered a particular pavilion to be raised, citizens and students, activists and rescuers prevented the bulldozers from going in, and 48 hours later, 8 newborn babies were found alive in the rubble. And this was one of the symbols at the time and an expression at the time to Mexicans of the possible power of civil society, as they call it, of independent organization by citizens.
I want to talk about, have you talk about two elections that demonstrate the lengths to which the PRI would go to hold on to power. The first one of those was in 1986 in the state of Chihuahua, where the country's largest opposition party, the PAN, looked like it had a pretty good chance to win the election for governor there. And in Mexico, because there aren't that many states and they're big, the governor of the state is a very powerful person in the state of Mexico. So there was an election in 1986, which was widely believed to have been stolen from the PAN by the PRI. What happened there?
Well, it was a very interesting confrontation in Chihuahua. You've got to kind of think about Chihuahua as it's a state way off from the Mexican capital. Think of it a little bit as though there had been a federal fraud in an election in Wyoming, and all the people of Wyoming get real, real angry about the sort of beltway bureaucrats that are imposing a fraud and denying them their free vote. This is kind of the atmosphere that developed in Chihuahua that summer. Chihuahuans across parties, including many, they had a socialist party in Chihuahua, and they were up in arms. The Catholic Church actually played a significant role in denouncing the fraud. The Archbishop of Chihuahua ordered a strike by all the priests. He forbade them to say mass. And people swarmed out onto the Pan American Highway with their cars and just, like, parked all their cars. They'd get 500 cars out on the Pan American Highway and they'd just park them. So there were these huge highway blockages. They blocked all the bridges in the city of Ciudad Juarez, which is across from El Paso, Texas. You have 5 or 6 bridges over the Rio Grande that are international bridges, and people swarmed out onto the bridges and then just sat down and blocked the traffic. It really had an extraordinary drama that played out. And in this case, the citizens' movement, which was, it just kind of came out of nowhere. And actually, people from other parts of Mexico, a number of intellectuals and just people that were curious, actually traveled to Chihuahua and participated in this movement. They finally did not prevail. The government then, the PRI and its government were still overwhelmingly powerful, and they put down the protests and they installed their governor that had been elected by fraud. But again, this was a process in which the democratic movement was building its momentum. There was a developing energy, and Chihuahua was one of those milestones. Mm.
2 years later, there was a presidential election in Mexico, and the PRI did the same thing on the national level. I guess people generally believe that the opposition candidate who was running, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, won, was actually elected president of Mexico, or would have if the PRI had allowed things to go along. However, in a seemingly kind of ham-handed way, they said the computer that had been counting the votes had broken down, and then they just declared they had won. Right?
Yes, correct. This is the 1988 elections are remembered in the Mexican collective memory, kind of like Watergate is in the United States. It's it's a time when they actually have a phrase for that year. They call it because when a computer goes down in Spanish, they say the system crashed, that's what you say in English. So
the system fell.
The system fell. Yeah. So everyone remembers 1988 as the year that the system crashed because on the evening of the vote count, they had computer terminals set up to provide the opposition parties with preliminary results. That was an innovation at the time in Mexico because they'd never needed to give preliminary results in any other election, any other presidential election, because elections throughout the 20th century were won by the PRI by 80% and 90%. So there was never any curiosity previously about what the preliminary results could be because the results were always a foregone conclusion. But by this time, with Mexico watching elections in other countries with early vote counts and all that sort of stuff, they set up this computer system to provide preliminary results. But then when the preliminary results showed that Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas was leading in Mexico City, they just turned off the computer. And so that detonated a similar kind of citizens outpouring that began that very night with the candidates of all the major parties, all the major opposition parties. There were two large opposition parties and then a scattering of smaller ones marching arm in arm down the main avenue of Mexico City to the Interior Ministry with hundreds of followers in tow. They actually got into the gates were opened and they charged in and had a face-to-face confrontation with the Interior Minister who gave a kind of lame excuse for why this had happened. And this, the energy of this protest movement lasted for about 2 months with the largest protest demonstrations in Mexican history occurred that summer in the Central Plaza of Mexico. They call it the Zócalo, and it's surrounded by the National Palace and the National Cathedral and the Mexico City Hall, and on one side is an Aztec ruin. It's one of the largest explanadas in the world, very dramatic. Probably a lot of listeners have been there. They filled this Zócalo several times to overflowing, and it was a very fascinating moment because just 2 years before, the Velvet Revolution had occurred in the Philippines when the democratic protesters there just sort of swarmed through the streets and disarmed the soldiers and took over. And then looted Imelda Marcos's shoe closets. This was in the imagination of many Mexican Democrats. They thought that one way to handle this this tremendous national fraud in Mexico in 1988 was doing the same thing, to just rush the National Palace and disarm the police and, in a sense, have an insurrection. But we have to give credit in retrospect to a man named Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, the candidate who had been defrauded, because he saw that this was a recipe for bloodshed on a scale that would not have had any precedent all the way back to the 1910 revolution. And he very wisely said, no, the answer is not to confront the army and the battalions and the cannons. The answer is to step back and systematically build our opposition political parties. And he took a lot of heat from it at the time. Many people were disappointed. But in the long run, looking back, it's possible to see that he made a very historic contribution at that moment by keeping things peaceful.
The candidate of the PRI, Carlos Salinas, became president. Did he do anything to address the perception that the PRI had stolen the election?
I'll answer that question in a minute, I wanted to just say something about our book, David, for your readers that who might be interested in this, which is that we were privileged to be in Mexico in July of 2000 when the PRI system fell, and we were doing a lot of our interviewing for our book right after that, and it was a unique moment in Mexican history, because many people felt liberated by the fall of the PRI, including many PRIistas, or many people who had you know, supported the system or been involved with it in one way or the other. And so we were able to go back, and Sam particularly did reporting with the people who actually had hands-on roles on the night of the election in 1988 to find out what did actually happen. Mexicans had a whole mythology about the election in 1988, but they didn't really know what actually happened. And so one of the things that we do in our book is describe that. And it was really an honor for us to be able to have this moment to go back, and when Mexicans were so excited about the new possibilities, political possibilities, that they wanted to talk and rediscover what had happened in these crucial moments leading up to it. In terms of Salinas, Salinas was well aware that his mandate was tainted when he came to power. And the way that he dealt with it was to just ignore it as much as he could. He saw to it that the ballots from the 1988 election were ultimately burned so that the real question of what actually happened, who won the election, will probably never be known. Salinas went ahead and, as we know, became an extremely forceful and in some ways radical president of Mexico. He had a vision of economic reform and economic opening, which was extremely progressive for the time. He negotiated NAFTA, as we all know. I think NAFTA would not have happened if it had not been for the determination and the discipline of Carlos Salinas. It was a NAFTA in itself was a treaty that basically brought Mexico up to date, brought Mexican economic structures up to date with the reality of the country, which is that it was closely enmeshed with the United States, and Mexicans were immigrating back and forth all the time. NAFTA brought Mexico up to the level of being a trading partner with the United States as opposed to being a sort of a vassal in some way or another. So Salinas' economic vision, I think we can say, was very progressive, and the problem was that from the outset of his term with that tainted political mandate, he never carried out a serious political reform. And at the end of his term, I think that came back to bite him.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580, and I would like to introduce again our guests, Julia Preston and Samuel Dillon. They were Mexico correspondents for The New York Times from 1995 until 2000. They were part of a team at The Times that won the 1998 Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. And if you're interested in reading on this history, you can look for their book, Opening Mexico. The subtitle is The Making of a Democracy, and it is published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, and is out in bookstores now. Questions are welcome. We do have somebody here ready to go. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Also toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Champaign County, and it's line one. Hello?
Hi. Yeah, I don't think Mexico is any less a vassal of the United States. I think NAFTA actually implemented that more. I think back to the famous quote, Mexico, poor Mexico, so far from God,
so close to the United States.
Yeah, and this is the for the first half hour, the United States wasn't mentioned at all. I mean, Salinas is in disgrace because he was corrupt. And the negotiation of NAFTA was corrupt because they were floating the peso. They knew it was going to go down. It was all based on a quite a big lie, it seems to me. I don't know if this is your spin on things, but the way that the book has been presented is shows this like democratic trajectory that's starting in 68 and the success of PAN. Well, I mean, Fox is absolutely abysmally unpopular. There's corruption in the Green Party. There's absolutely, it's almost as much of a disaffected political reality there as there is in the United States, it seems to me. It's quite scary. There have been armed groups in up to six provinces. We hear about Chiapas every now and again, and it's kind of a standoff there with the PRI still being in power and it being an occupied zone. So I think the complexity is not served. For being so close to Mexico for all these and being so powerful in Mexico, the ignorance of Americans about Mexico and its politics is, you can only do so much in a talk show, but I really contest your modesty.
You make some good points. Let me answer a couple of them.
Please.
One of the things that you mentioned is that we haven't talked a lot about the United States, and that's a good perception. Our point is, obviously, the United States has played an extraordinary interventionist role throughout much of Mexican history, including the 1847 revolution invasion, where we lopped off the top half of Mexico and turned it into California and Colorado and all our western states. But in this democratic history that we lay out, this is not like Iraq. This was not a democracy that the United States exported through invasion or in any way was a real major player in. Mexicans built this democracy themselves, and so we thought that was a truth that was largely unperceived by Americans, and that in our book we wanted to tell the story of Mexicans taking the initiative and being the principal protagonist instead of American puppets. As far as the current disaffection in Mexico that you refer to, I think that's fair. It is true that some people that were entranced by Fox have become disaffected. Although Mexico is divided politically in the same way that the United States is. It's a somewhat polarized country, and so Fox has not lost his hard core of supporters. He's not been a great executive. It's a good perception. He was, as a Coca-Cola executive, he wasn't really an operator. He was a salesman, and because that was the function of Coca-Cola in Mexico, to market Coca-Cola, because Coca-Cola is bottled by regional bottlers, and so he didn't have a huge workforce or... So in the political sphere, this translated into him being a much better campaigner than he's turned out to be as a chief executive. But you know, give Mexico a break. It's not a perfect society, and democracy hasn't solved all of the problems. There are institutions in Mexico that remain undemocratic. But you know, look at our own system.
That's a point I would make, and that's exactly what I thought of. We have a corruption that's sort of official, and we haven't had any political assassinations like the Colosio assassination that Salinas was most likely involved with, which was internecine in the PRI. But we do have a corruption that's So I'm not looking down on Mexico. I'm just saying. It's much more complicated. The PAN is a kind of a Catholic party, and it was not it was sort of a third party in a way for the collapse of the party that that actually won the other election. And in the U.S.
I think you would be quite interested in the line of argument in this book. This book is not a history of how Vicente Fox won the election. What we tried to do was say, you know, the fact, what's important here is not Fox. What was important here was that an opposition candidate took power. And Fox was just, was a little music that came in the last 15 minutes of this really, very significant symphony that people all over Mexico, including, in our view, the Zapatistas, played for many years, very patiently, and the central part of our book is we try and tell the stories of people who came up from the grassroots, and you know we talk about elections reformers, and we talk about human rights activists, we talk about women who there's a chapter about a woman whose son was kidnapped and she discovered that the police were complicit in the kidnapping of her son. And it talks a little bit about the way that families organize to try and defend themselves against that kind of corruption in government. And so I actually think you would be interested in the line of argument that we may.
I want to ask you about one thing that the caller just touched on, and then I have some other callers I want to get to. And this was the assassination in 1994 of Luis Donaldo Colosio, and he was the man, as you mentioned earlier, the president would always pick whoever would succeed him. So Carlos Salinas chose this man to succeed him, and he was assassinated. That then brought about the unlikely presidency of Ernesto Zedillo. Who do you know? Does anyone know who was responsible for the Colosio assassination and why he was killed?
Well, I think we could say that this was the equivalent of the Kennedy assassination for Mexico. It took the government 6 years and several administrations and various special prosecutors to conduct an investigation of this. The conclusion was that this man named Mario Aburto, was a single assassin. No one believed it. The truth, I think, will probably never be known. I think there is, in terms of the assassination itself, the perception that Carlos Salinas was behind it, I think it says more about the perception by everyday Mexicans of the level of corruption in general in the Salinas administration than a specific facts about the assassination and whether Salinas was involved. One of the biggest losers in the politics following the assassination of Luis Donaldo was Salinas himself, because he lost control of the political process, and the man who ended up becoming president after him, as we all know, ended up becoming his most determined and fiercest political enemy. And so just on political grounds, I think you can question whether whether Salinas had a role. However, there's no doubt about it that what the Colosio assassination said to everybody, it was yet another sign to everybody that the pre-system was cannibalizing itself, that the pre-system had become decadent and corrupt and dangerous to a point that Mexicans were beginning to find intolerable.
Let's take another call. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi, I'd like to make a comment about the situation with Vicente Fox. In my experiences in Mexico, it's not that the Mexican people, he polls very poorly, but it's not that the Mexican people don't like Vicente Fox. It's that they're very frustrated that what he campaigned on, he's not been able to achieve. And the reason he hasn't been able to achieve that is because in the Mexican Congress and throughout the state governments, his party has very little power. So that all the proposals that he's made that were really very popular inside Mexico with many of the Mexicans haven't been able to be fulfilled because of the lack of political party power at the Congress and at the state level. And then another thing that has to be remembered is Mexico is a lot different than the United States. Mexico doesn't go to war with other countries. Mexico stays very within itself. The Mexican people will express some political interest, but you won't see Mexicans donating thousands of dollars to the Republicans or thousands of dollars to the Democrats. They're not politically active like Americans are. They have many more other important things to deal with than worrying about who's being elected into political office. So the political movement inside Mexico involves much smaller amounts of people, and in areas where the people are being grossly abused rather than just putting up with an everyday amount of corruption there in Mexico, which is everywhere. I mean, in Mexico, the Mexican people say you never look a policeman in the eye, because you never know when he's going to kill you. They live under a total different setup than anything that Americans can even comprehend. Americans have no comprehension of the kind of political oppression that the Mexican people feel. So most Americans couldn't even possibly understand what goes on in Mexico, and they certainly aren't being enlightened by the American media. I mean, the American media absolutely ignores the situation.
Well, you want to comment on that, Ms. Breslin and Mr. Dillon?
Well, I think your comments are interesting. The first part of your statement is well-informed about the frustrations that Fox is feeling because of the impasse in Congress. And I guess I don't know you, but it sounds like you've spent quite a bit of time in Mexico yourself. I guess the only thing I might think is that I think actually there's quite a number of there are probably many millions of Americans who have visited Mexico and to one degree or another have done a little self-education about it. I think that our aim in writing our book was to offer. It was a tremendously exhilarating experience for us to watch the last half of the 90s up close in Mexico and see that Mexicans were really engaged in a very inspiring national renovation. And all the terrible things about the sort of repressive atmosphere in Mexico where you can't look a policeman in the eye, we understood all of those things, and we experienced them probably much in the same ways that you did. But we also saw another side of Mexico emerging and ordinary Mexicans feeling new powers. And we felt absolutely compelled to write a book that would illustrate the long history that had produced this movement. And so, give our book a chance, read it. I think you and other people that have visited Mexico and know quite a bit about it may find it to be interesting.
We're coming into our last 10 minutes here, and I want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit more about the election of Vicente Fox in 2000, because while previously the opposition had some success. In 1997, the PRI lost its majority in Congress in Mexico for the first time ever, and Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas was elected the mayor of Mexico City. It was really clear that the PRI was not going to give up power particularly easily. And you write in the book that at the opening of 2000, it seemed that the PRI would win the presidency again, and yet that summer, Fox won. He was elected president in July 2000. How did that come about?
Thing we need to understand about this is that this was the culmination of an effort over decades by many people focused on elections reform. One of the reasons that Fox was able to claim and keep his victory on July 2nd, 2000 was that the elections machinery in Mexico had been so improved and reformed that it really wasn't an option for the PRI to revert the result of the vote at the polls. And, this was a very patient work by a lot of people, and especially, I think, stands in contrast to what happened, for example, in the United States in the elections in the same period, where, we had all these problems here that we had, would formerly been commonplace in Mexico. Mexicans spent more than $1 billion getting their voting system up to date. And they have voter cards that have holograms on them. They have digital fingerprints on the voter lists. We forget this, but the fact that today Mexicans go to the polls with confidence that they can express their views and as to who they would like to govern them and have those views stick, this is a big change in this country that I think is little underappreciated. A little appreciated, excuse me.
It's now a couple of years until the next election. Are people already in Mexico gearing up for that, and what do you think is likely to happen?
Unfortunately, they are. Fox's administration is just 3 years into, 3 years and a little bit into its six-year term. And there's actually a lot that needs to be done. The Congress and Fox and other actors in the society should be rolling up their sleeves to solve many of the country's problems. Unfortunately, the country is already gearing up and the parties are positioning themselves for the next election in 2006. And that's going to mean probably that the country will waste a lot of time and squander a lot of energy in sort of political wheel turning. It's an interesting. We're fortunate in a way because we were able to forecast with we've had some luck in forecasting who the major forces were going to be in these 2006 elections. And so for people that are interested in the way the presidential contest of 2006 will play out, they might get our book and look at the left candidate is almost certainly to be López Obrador, who's the Mexico City mayor. He's a protagonist in our book. The Fox's party will could very well come up with Santiago Creel as a candidate. He's currently the he's the interior minister, and he's also a protagonist. And the guy that's now the head of the PRI could be the candidate, and he's also plays a there's some interesting chapters where he's a major figure. Although, who knows? Many things can happen between now and 2006. But in answer to your question, yes, the country is already in the grip of presidential fever.
President, the Mexican president, Vicente Fox, was in the United States just a couple of weeks ago. He met with President Bush, and apparently the number one thing on their agenda for their talks was immigration. President Bush has already made a proposal earlier this year to create what would amount to be a guest worker program for the United States to allow people to come for a period of time and work. Then they would be required to leave, and the idea is that that's not supposed to make it any easier for them to become citizens, just that they become here for a fixed period of time and work. But this obviously is a very important issue to the two of them, that is to Bush and Fox. And I wonder what you think about that and about the salience of that issue, immigration, both in American politics and in Mexican politics.
Well, it's hugely important. It's got to be one of North America's most pressing social issues. One interesting detail about this is that I view this as an issue that, in a sense, Mexican democracy has forced it onto the U.S. political agenda because no previous Mexican president ever pressed the issue of the conditions faced by undocumented workers in our country with the sort of forcefulness that Fox has brought it to the table. And he's done that because millions of Mexicans feel extremely strongly about it because these are their loved ones who are here living in the shadows. President Bush's proposal is a start, and I viewed it as I really wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt for bringing it to the table. As you say accurately, it is a guest worker proposal, which means that it solves only one of many problems that the system is broke currently, and there are many things that need to be fixed about it. One of the major goals in any successful immigration reform proposal would be to make sure that it brings all of the people who are currently in the shadows out of the shadows and register them. The national security problem that people talk of in relation to immigration is that we have 8 to 10 million undocumented people in the country. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they are. We don't know what they're doing, when they've come, when they're going, who they work for. So one goal is to get everybody signed up. Well, the only way to do that is, in the current situation, is to grasp fully these people's situations. And in many cases, these are people that have lived in our country for years and years, sometimes more than a decade. Many of them have fathered now American children. Many of them have been at the same jobs for many years. These are people that will not emerge from the shadows to sign up for a green card program unless they see a clear way down the road to legalizing their situation. Now, it isn't to say that they should get that for free. There need to be a mechanism that by which they earn the right to stay legally in the United States. But I think the single major flaw of President Bush's program currently is that it does not clearly lay out a roadmap by which these people will have the chance to claim a legal status, and so it won't work. I mean, the main problem is it just won't work until he fleshes that out. The other problem is that he put forward a proposal conveniently just in advance of his meeting with Fox in Monterey in January, and has since offered no legislation. So it's beginning to look a little bit like a campaign stunt. But nonetheless, I still think it was so important to come forward with a proposal and get the debate going, because it's a terrible problem and we need to address it.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We could keep going, I'm sure, but we've used our time. And for people who are interested in reading more about Mexico, one book you might look at is the one we've talked about here this morning by our guests. It's titled Opening Mexico, The Making of a Democracy, published by Farrar Straus Giroux, by our guest Julia Preston and Samuel Dillon. They were Mexico correspondents for The New York Times from 1995 until 2000. And Ms. Preston, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was wonderful.
And Mr. Dillon, thank you.
Thanks for your generosity with us.
We appreciate your time.